Welcome back to Radio EcoShock. Climate change hit hard these past few months, even just within this past week. Extreme weather is striking all over the world.
But first, let's get to the extreme heat that's affecting many portions of the country.
Damage from powerful storms around the world. We're beginning with severe flooding. This nation's midsection, Oklahoma, Missouri, and parts of Arkansas as well. These areas have all been hit with tornadoes.
Climate change has certainly shown up here on planet Earth in a big way these past few months. Records are falling so fast with so many new changes, it's beyond our ability to track it all. But let's do a recap of some big climate news with one of our popular guests, Paul Beckwith. Paul is a PhD graduate student in the Laboratory for Paleoclimatology and Climatology, and he's a part-time professor at the University of Ottawa in Canada. He has a master's degree in physics as well. Paul, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Well, doing good, and I'm really glad that we got in touch because I've been following your Facebook page, and it's a very lively spot and a good place to keep up with what's going on. I wanted to start with the state of the Arctic sea ice. You made a prediction earlier this year that if we had the right cyclones at the right times, that maybe it could all break up this year. What is happening there?
Well, almost this year, the Arctic sea ice has been in a state that's been almost completely opposite to last year. Last year, it was very warm over the sea ice, and there were some massive cyclones, and the sea ice was kind of broken up into these very large chunks, and a lot of these large chunks were exported out through the Fram Strait and other parts of the Arctic. This year, it looked like we would have a very similar year initially, especially in March with the large cracking and breaking up of the ice, but it seems that what has happened this year is that the ice, rather than being broken up and exported in large chunks, it got completely shattered and fractured and broken up into very small chunks. And these small chunks, of course, will have a much larger surface area. And this larger surface area, since the melting is just the ice in contact with water, warm water or warm air, the melt rate of the individual ice pieces seemed to be much larger. And what that did is it kept the temperatures lower over the Arctic. Of course, we saw over Alaska and Siberia and other places, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, is warmer areas over there, although it was cooler over the Arctic sea ice. And I think the ice is actually creating that climate. So this would act as somewhat of a negative feedback to, on the short-term scale, to keep the ice. And the other thing is there were a number of these cyclones, but they weren't of the same magnitude as last year's. And instead of operating on pushing large chunks of ice out of the Arctic like they did last year, this year what they did is they caused a spreading out or a divergence of the ice, which was mostly first-year ice. So they kept the area of the sea ice larger. Of course, the thickness has still been dropping very quickly, so it'll be interesting to compare the thickness numbers with previous years because it was the Arctic ice volume that was falling exponentially.
Right. The other big story among many that you've been following are methane releases in the Arctic. What has happened there this year? What's going on with research? What are the levels of methane releases in the Arctic?
The methane, we've seen over the last number of years increases in methane emissions coming from the Arctic region. And these methane emissions are primarily from two sources. One is the on-land permafrost and tundra. When it melts or when it's subjected to wave action on the coast, we see large emissions of methane from that region. Also, the Arctic snow cover has been dropping rapidly, in fact, more rapidly than the sea ice, and most in the spring months. So sort of May, June months, the snow cover has been dropping extremely rapidly. So this exposes the underlying permafrost and tundra and thus can lead to warming and methane releases. Also, we've been seeing significant increases in methane coming up from areas that are uncovered when the sea ice is opened up and leaves, and it leaves behind the dark ocean water, that will absorb more sunlight and warm up. And we have been seeing the warming up of the ocean completely down to the 50-meter deep continental shell. So that then will thaw sediments on the seafloor and cause increases. So areas where there was no sea ice from the melt, we would see increases in methane. And there are overflights done frequently now with methane instruments to measure sort of distributions of methane. And it's interesting because methane measurements, there's no reason why we can't get better and better measurements. Mass spectrometers were used a lot before, but you can have very low-cost spectrometers, laser spectrometers, which can measure methane concentrations to very high levels. And people are starting to do some of these near gas fields, near natural gas fields, near fracking sites, also from aircraft in various places. And there are very sensitive sensors on satellites, the atmospheric infrared satellites, or short form is AIRS satellites. There's lots of good methane data. You can go to methanetracker.org, I believe it is, or .com, and get lots of slices through the atmosphere of methane. The thing about methane in the Arctic, too, is the global warming potential of methane, the number that people are familiar with is 22 or 25 times relative to CO2, but that's on a 100-year time scale. On a decade or two-year time scale, it's more like 70, and if you look at it on a few-year time scale, then it's more like 150 times. So if you have a methane source in the Arctic, methane's coming up, it will stay above that region for a while before it spreads around the planet, and it can cause significant localized warming of regions where it's coming up from.
Well, Dr. Shakova of the University of Alaska and others with her in Russia have been investigating this, and they have said that it's possible we could get a huge burst of methane if the landscape under the sea shifts around a little bit. You get some landslides or something. And then Peter Wadhams, who you know very well, has brought out a study with others saying if that happened, it could cost $60 trillion. Talk to us about that, would you?
Yes, the basic thing that methane has the power to basically change the background climate of our planet. So changing the background climate, and it can do this over a very short time scale, a time scale of decades or a decade or two or even shorter. We know this because we have seen in the paleo records of the past periods of time where the Earth's temperature shifted very rapidly in regions, and this has been attributed to methane in at least a few different cases, if not many cases. And the reason is because in the Arctic, if you have the jet stream circling the planet and kind of keeping the colder air north of the jet streams, warmer air south, and so the methane coming up in the Arctic has the potential to stay there for longer than it would at other locations of the planet. You know, this also ties into the jet stream. When you get jet streams that are very distorted because of the reduced temperature gradient between the pole Arctic and the equator, then since weather patterns follow these jet streams, you can get very, and they're slowing, you can get very persistent storm activity or very persistent blocking activity, which, for example, leads to very high temperatures in Alaska for weeks on end, as we saw earlier in the summer, and then very, very warm temperatures over Siberia and other regions, whereas some regions further south or further from the pole get very warm temperatures. For example, the jet streams in the southern hemisphere, not too many people talk about them, but they are also behaving in an unusual fashion, and we saw them extend up over large parts of South America, leading to record cold temperatures in South America, and they had record levels of snowfall in the Atacama Desert, which is very, very unusual. I mean, this is a place where there's weather stations there that have not registered any precipitation for 400 years. Depending on who you believe, the rainfall there on an annual basis is less than 10 millimeters, according to some. In some regions higher up, it's like 0.1 millimeter. And suddenly when we get 20 or 30 centimeters of snow in these regions, it's a very, very unusual event. although it did happen just a few years ago. So we're seeing two extremely low likelihood events happening back to back down there. And if you happen to be north of those jet streams in the southern hemisphere, like in New Zealand, you get record high temperatures, the highest temperatures they've seen. They've seen temperatures higher I think mean annual temperatures are higher by several degrees in New Zealand, for example. Whereas, as I mentioned, in South America, average mean temperatures have been almost, 5 to 9 degrees colder. Just depends on where you are relative to these curved jet streams.
Yes, they're huge bends. I mean, they're saying up to 250,000 alpacas died in Bolivia and Peru, that the crops that are essential to feed people there have been severely damaged by this finger of cold coming up from Antarctica. And meanwhile, as you say, in New Zealand, they had the warmest winter they've ever recorded. So it may help their agriculture a little bit. It depends on where you're standing. Back to Siberia just for a minute. Extreme floods in eastern Russia along the Amur River in particular, right on the border with China. It's part of Siberia, though. Things that they've never seen before. Putin went over there and tried to get people working on it even more. It hasn't gone down yet, may not for months. Thousands flooded out. It's a big event.
Yeah, what is happening is the climate has warmed, and because it's warm, there's more evaporation. So for every degree of warming over a particular region, there's about 7% more water vapor in the atmosphere. And the reason that's important is because that water vapor, as it climbs higher into the atmosphere, it condenses, forming the clouds and, leads to rainfall. So there's more water vapor in the air, there's more condensation, more rainfall, and that the energy, tremendous amounts of energy are required to evaporate water, but also that energy is released when that water condenses into clouds. So these storms are more, they have more energy, they're more extreme, they're more violent storms, and they're basically trending along the jet stream patterns, jet stream regions. So if the jet streams are operating, are moving more slowly west to east, then those storms are more persistent. And we're seeing these large flooding events, like the jet stream kind of stalled and twisted, it was raising water vapor over the Rockies in the summer a few months ago. So this caused extreme rainfall on the slopes near Banff, and of course that water plug in all the rivers moved right through into Calgary, flooding out Calgary, as we all remember. And the costs of that event are $3 to $5 billion, they're saying. I think it's well over three at the latest count. And then a week or two or a few weeks after that happened, a similar but different event happened in Toronto. And in Toronto's case, you had warm, moist air coming off of Lake Ontario being swept up with a very fast jet stream streak. And it pulled it all up through, and it was deposited over large areas of Toronto with the maximum rainfalls in the western parts. 3 inches of rain, 75 millimeters in between 5 and 6 p.m., I believe, on the day of the storm. And then over the rest of the storm, there were another 2 inches or 50 millimeters of rain. So this was 3 to 5 to higher. There was some areas that were even higher rainfall, on a city in one evening. And of course, the water has to go somewhere because the ground was mostly saturated from previous rainfall. It was mostly just runoff and ended up in underpasses and did major damage. And this is, I think the number on that price-wise was about $800 million or something, probably still counting. So it's just, I think it's important for all cities to sort of look at, assume such a rainfall event, 5 inches in a night, 6 inches, determine the low areas of the city, determine where the water's going, what effect it's going to have, how long it will take to drain off, and so on. It's only prudent that cities do this, because many, many cities around the planet are experiencing this. In Manila, we expect lots of rain there. We hear of them being flooded out frequently. They have monsoons parts of the year. But they received about 2 feet of rain in 24 hours. And even in a very extreme monsoon, they might get about a foot of rain in 3 or 4 days or a week or something, not 2 feet in one 24-hour period. So, of course, that flooded out three-quarters of the country. But, you know, news is weighed very differently by people, by decision makers, depending on where it comes from. You know, stuff that happens locally to where you live, if you're a decision maker, weighs on your policies much, much more than, you know, on some other part of the, you know, some distant part of the world, or even in third world countries, you know, less developed countries. So these events are happening, you know, in any given week you can find events like this happening around the world. It's just the ones that have more significance on us and on our, you know, what we remember about the climate and, you know, further changes in policy and so on, politicians' views, they're not sticking all these events. They don't see the big picture of how the climate is changing.
Sure. I mean, who cares about Siberia? We hardly even heard about these Russian floods. It wasn't on the mainstream media. And I totally agree with you about every country is sort of focused on themselves, and then they don't hear about the world picture. But getting to North America, I think what a lot of people in the United States are thinking about is that super fire in Yosemite area of California. Again, it was just a record setter and an amazing fire. Do you think those conditions could be climate-related?
I don't think there's any question that what climate does, it sets up persistent weather patterns in the case of fires of, you know, drought, and it dries out the soil. I mean, you know, if you're in a drought that's not lasting too long, then the soil has retained a lot of moisture, and then that can keep the vegetation going. But then as the soil moisture vanishes in a persistent drought or more severe drought, first of all, it weakens the trees, and then they get attacked more by things like pine beetle and different or emerald ash borer. So they become very weakened in the first place. And then when a fire comes, it will burn that much hotter and that much intensely and carry right down into the soils, burning parts of the organic matter in the soils. And then it will create these very strong updrafts, creating this phenomenon which is sometimes seen called firenados. It's almost like a tornado with, you know, flames spiraling up very high. And, of course, things like that can spread the fire. And then so they're burning much hotter, and they're burning much larger areas. Some friends of mine, I used to live in the Thousand Oaks area of California, and I think it was back in March, there were some very unusual, very large fires that occurred in that region, and they basically burned from the area of Thousand Oaks and they made it almost down to the ocean about 20 miles away, just going through the valleys and so on. So I think with fires, I think it's very important that we kind of change our strategies with fires, and because it seems like me that these fires, they start, and then there's resources put to try to contain them, but and then later on they get enormous, and then we throw enormous resources at them. Well, it just makes sense that when these fires start, we throw enormous resources on them and put them out before they can develop into these super fire type events.
More adaptation. And I'll just mention in passing that the USDA has talked about a flash drought of unseasonably hot and dry weather in the Midwest that affects corn and wheat prices in Kansas right through to Iowa. We don't have really time to talk about that right now. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Paul Beckwith. He's studying and teaching climate science at the University of Ottawa in Canada. Well, Paul, I think we should get a little bit more back to the science here, and in particular about the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. Now, they're operating on a six-year cycle. Look at all the things we've just been talking about, and we barely scratched the surface of what's going on the Earth right now. How's the IPCC system working out for us?
Well, I think the next massive report from the IPCC, which is following that six-year cycle, is due out, I believe it's this month. So I think that this report should be sort of the basis moving forward, and I think what we need to do is have a report generated. Like, first of all, you know, who generates these reports? I mean, it's basically volunteer scientists who are specialized in their particular area, and they acquire papers and get people, you know, authors to contribute to different sections that they're responsible for in the report. So there's a lot of work involved for some of these people, and they obviously they can't be doing this all the time. So I think once you have the this report come out, the basis report, I think it should be the last sort of six-year report. I think moving forward, I think whenever a significant paper comes out that adds a lot of new information that is very important to humanity on climate change, that there should be an update going into the IPCC webpage and document. There has to be a way to make it more relevant to people. I mean, it's very important for us to be tracking, you know, in one place what is going on. So but I think whether it go down to like 6 months updates or yearly updates, but these updates can be short. They could just be, we were wrong with this projection. The much more accurate projection is such and such. You know, because one of the areas that the IPCC is still not really covering is methane emissions from the Arctic. I mean, we'll see when the report comes out, but the models that are coming out in this report are assuming that the methane is mostly staying in place. And if we're not seeing that happen, then the report is just missing this. And it's the report can actually do more harm than good in that case, if it's not reflecting the reality of a rapidly changing climate system. Just the other day, I saw somebody suggesting that perhaps the IPCC reports on the different sections could be sort of like a wiki, which is a sequential blog, basically, so that if there's new research and new things updated, then they could be quickly given the okay by they could be sent out to like some of the key scientists in that area, who can then look at it and say, yes, we'll go with this. And then it could be on an updated sort of wiki or blog or something. Like the idea of a report every 6 years, with the speed of information travel through social networks and through, you know, online journals and stuff, it just makes no sense to maintain the existing IPCC model of once every 6 years.
No, I want to see big buildings appear in every continent full of scientists that are working full-time on integrating this information in real time and bringing it out to the public so that we can do something or adapt and try and reduce our emissions. Well, look, you are kind of breaking the model of what a scientist has been. You know, it used to be that a scientist was expected to keep quiet until they publish a paper, so it might be years of work, and then suddenly they say something, versus Stephen Schneider's, the late Stephen Schneider's wonderful book, Science as a Contact Sport, where he said, that's not going to work. Things are moving too fast. Climate scientists need to be active communicators, and you're certainly doing that. How do you feel about this change of role?
The old model is being quiet and just publishing. That's a norm, basically, that old model. And it's a norm in many different fields of science. And it's important to have some people that are still following that model, but in areas like climate science where, you know, you study it, I can just about guarantee that anybody studying it and getting to know sort of the nuances and the ins and outs, and not just studying a very specialized area like, say, glaciology or permafrost physics, you know, science, or, you know, methane emissions or atmospheric science. I mean, it's a multidisciplinary field that is very important to have people that are looking at the overall big picture, that are basically reviewing what other people have done in all these different areas and trying to fit it together as pieces, taking these areas as pieces of a big jigsaw puzzle, trying to fit the puzzle together to enable one to see, you know, where we're going, what's happening with the climate, what's going to happen next. I mean, there's still going to be lots of surprises. For example, last year we had record temperatures in the Arctic and record loss of ice. This year we had record temperatures on the fringes, on the land around the Arctic, but we had very cold temperatures over the Arctic, and, you know, a huge whiplash or seesaw from one to the other. And we're seeing this whiplash and seesaw in many areas. For example, you know, if you live near the Mississippi, we had record low levels in January. In December of last year, the Army Corps of Engineers was hydraulically blasting rock on the bottom of the Mississippi to deepen the channel so that the barge traffic, which is vital to the economic well-being of the U.S., so that could be maintained. And then about 3 or 4 or 5 months later, we were back to record levels of water in those areas, you know, record and flooding. And the year before the drought and the drying up had occurred, we also had record levels, record flooding. So there's lots of things that are going to happen, which throw us for loops. But that doesn't mean that it's still very important to try to understand the system and also to be very flexible. So if your views and ideas on how the system is behaving are not working out or completely wrong or reversed, you try to incorporate, rather than that stopping you from trying to figure out what the system is doing, it's important to incorporate that new knowledge and try to find out what you missed, where you're going. Because the models kind of do that. They do that on an analytical calculation type basis. But there's still lots of things that the human brain can do in terms of pattern recognition to understand the climate system. And then those things can be verified by observations and by models further down the line.
Well, I think we can say we've destabilized the climate, so it's the change part of climate change that we better get used to. From the Laboratory for Paleoclimatology and Climatology at the University of Ottawa, Canada, we have been speaking with Paul Beckwith. Paul, I've followed you very actively on Facebook, as I said. Is that the best way for people to keep up with you?
I think, yes, probably my Facebook page, which is just Paul Beckwith, B-E-C-K-W-I-T-H. And also my Twitter feeds, which is P-A-U-L, Paul H. Beckwith, B-C-K-W-I-T-H, no spaces. I also blog for various blogs like Arctic News and the Sierra Club Canada and the Canadian Daily and many other ones also.
Good enough. Find this program as a free download and more links to the stories we've been discussing with Paul in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening. My thanks to all the people who donated or signed up for our monthly Radio EcoShock membership at the website ecoshock.org. I have not had time to thank you all personally. This past month has been almost constant turmoil for me. Aside from vehicle breakdowns, we are renovating and preparing to move out of Vancouver to a rural village. More about that in coming shows. 1 week ago, the main hard drive on my production computer died. I lost everything. I'm working on the fly from an ancient box out of our basement, coping as I can. Without the help of Radio EcoShock listeners, I'm not sure we could afford the repairs. The refurbished audio computer will be back online in a week or so. My next show may be right out of the moving van. These changes in my personal life seem to echo the big changes happening on the planet and in our society. I tell myself, we are all going to need fallback plans, preparation, and an ability to adapt or move, perhaps on short notice. It could be fires, it could be floods, it could be storms, it could be economic problems, we don't know yet. The days of growing up in a stable society, where you can plan on one education for one lifetime job, it's pretty well done for most of us. Already the average person may have two or three careers. As the economic engine winds down, and it will, along with the environment, and it is, we'll have to expand our ideas about who we are and what a good life is. Our parents and grandparents went through 2 world wars and a Great Depression. If my reading of the climate, energy, and economic scene is correct, they had it easy. Expect to enjoy life, sure, but expect to struggle as well. I'm hoping to help you do both in coming shows, while being brutally honest about my own attempts, failures, shortcomings, and small wins if they come. I am Alex Smith. Thank you so much for joining me in this new season of Radio EcoShock. Our music clips this week came from the marvelous Suvarna, plus Till the Day is Done by R.E.M.
What have I done?